You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my webpage at dr-history.com for over 440 true stories of the Old West. Also, now available on Amazon, my first book, a historical fiction based on true events entitled Coal Miner to Cowboy. The story of a young man born in England in 1850. He wants to be a cowboy and makes his way to America, travels from New Orleans to Independence on a steamboat, hires on as a teamster to Santa Fe, then on a cattle drive to Bozeman, Montana. He also rides shotgun on a stagecoach. He travels with a wagon train, and on his two-year journey, he meets some famous people and keeps a journal of his adventures. The book contains a lot of the true stories from my podcast and is now available on Amazon. Visit my webpage for a link to Amazon for the book, Coal Miner to Cowboy.
Dr. History.
So, Zeb, last week we talked about the printing presses, and we talked about how the typesetters had to be really accurate to get the words right.
What did you find out on that?
Well, I got an email from Austin, and he told me, you've heard the term, watch your P's and Q's.
Yeah.
That's where that came from, because a P and a Q look a lot alike. You've got to be able to put a P where it's supposed to be and a Q where it's supposed to be.
That's where that terminology came from?
Yeah, that's where that came from.
Oh, yeah. See, so, there you go.
Yeah. So I'm going to continue with kind of the writers of the Old West.
Okay, the authors.
The authors, okay. The people that helped settle the Old West.
I have a question regarding that. I was watching a TV show the other night, and oh my gosh, I forgot his name all of a sudden. He went from being a lawman to being a journalist. Which lawman was that? Oh, I forgot his name.
I'm not sure.
Oh my goodness sakes.
These are people from England. I'm going to talk about the English people that came over and with their writing actually encouraged the people back home, back in England, to come to America.
Really?
Yeah. So the first guy I'm going to talk about, okay, now pay attention, Zeb, to this name.
Listen, my attention is paid. Go ahead.
You're going to have to repeat this name when I get done.
All right.
Wyndham Thomas Wyndham Quinn, the 4th Earl of Dunraven. And Mount Earl.
Earl?
We're just gonna call him Dunraven.
Okay? Earl the Raven.
Earl of Dunraven.
Okay, Dunraven.
So basically, he had no intention of becoming a Western writer when he arrived in Colorado in the summer of 1874. He was a 34-year-old nobleman. He actually had 30,000 acres back in Ireland and Wales. That he owned.
30,000?
So he was a wealthy guy.
Wow.
And he had actually come to America to check on some tracts of land, ranch land, that he had bought.
Okay.
So Dunraven was kind of an adventurer, too. He set off on a wilderness excursion, and he said, I determined to pay a visit to the upper Yellowstone. He also planned to do some hunting. Now, to travel in his accustomed style, he included a local guide, a frontiersman named Texas Jack, his own English artist, a newfangled camera.
Newfangled.
Yeah. His personal physician, his Scottish gun bearer, his all-purpose servant, and his collie named Tweed.
You mean this guy, he had money.
Oh, well, yeah.
And he paid all these people.
Oh, yeah.
So he had an entourage.
Yeah. And that's not the biggest. I'm going to tell you another one. By American standards, this was kind of an oversized party, so to speak. But, you know, and it was just going to pay attention to one guy. That was just to take care of him. So, but compared to some of the other entourages that several other European aristocrats brought with them to the West, Dunraven's group was actually somewhat modest. 2 decades earlier, for example, Sir St. George Gore, and we did a story on him.
I remember that, yeah.
He was a wealthy man too, obviously. So he brought along to take care of his comforts on a 3-year-long hunting expedition. He took along 40 employees.
Oh, my goodness.
112 horses.
Oh, my goodness.
3 milk cows.
3 milk cows.
And enough champagne, as it says, to float a small boat.
And a partridge in a pear tree. Holy cow.
So back to the Earl of...
This is true. 3 milk cows?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm a milk drinker, Zeb. I am too.
But...
Yeah. So the Earl of Dunraven spent several glorious weeks sightseeing and hunting in Yellowstone, which had been established as a national park just 2 years before. And he came upon Mount Washburn, which is a 10,243-foot peak, kind of an easy climb. And he climbed it with one of his guides. And it's interesting, he and his guide got to the top of this granite summit, and it's actually the very crest of the Continental Divide.
Really?
When you're standing on top of there, on one side, the water's going to go one way, and on the other side, obviously, the water's going to go the other direction,
yeah,
to the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay.
So, you know, he stood up there, and he was amazed. Hundreds of square miles of, you know, forest. We've been up there, Zeb.
Yeah.
The prairie, the lakes, the mountains.
Beautiful.
You know, it's just amazing. And looking down at the streams and the mm-hmm. rivers that are, you know, are going to go into the Missouri, the Colorado, the Green River.
You can really attest to God's handiwork.
Yeah, the Snake River. Yeah. I mean, just amazing. So what he saw kind of caused him to write a book called The Great Divide.
Uh-huh.
So he returned occasionally to the West, and in 1877, he financed the building of a large English-style hotel near Long's Peak in Colorado. Does that sound familiar?
Long's Peak.
I'm not sure where that's
I'm
at.
I'm not either. Well, wait a minute. Is that over by Longmont, Colorado?
It could be. But he built a hotel that was considered the absolute best in the region, a really nice English hotel. So anyway, to heighten the pleasure of a Western journey, a lot of these foreign visitors wrote some kind of lively accounts of everything they did and saw. On the way, they kept journals, and they set down their impressions to letters to friends back home in England and probably Germany.
Can you imagine what it was like sitting at the campfire at night going, cheerio, old chap, what did you do today?
So they published these articles and books for the enlightenment of their less fortunate countrymen that were still back in Europe.
Wow.
And nothing did escape their detailed discussion. And I found this kind of funny. The weather, unpredictable. The natural resources, unlimited. The food and lodging, atrocious.
What do you expect out in the wild?
The clothing, picturesque but malodorous. I like that. Chewing tobacco, unspeakable. Of the Westerners' universal addiction to chewing, one British visitor asked, quote, why does the Westerner spit?
Uh-huh.
It can't amuse him, and it doesn't interest his neighbors. Another Englishman admired the chewer's accurate volleys of tobacco juice, but admitted that, quote, when you are surrounded with shooters, you feel nervous.
Did they have, they being those from jolly old England, didn't they have any vices of their own?
Oh, I'm sure they did. But, you know, they're looking at the Westerners, the cowboys.
Boy, the outlaw Josie Wales was able to spit right between the dog's eyes. They wouldn't have liked that at all.
Yeah, he was good. Now, the European writers wrote almost exclusively for writers in their own country, but these commentaries also inadvertently helped provide helpful information to the Americans that were also getting ready to head west.
Well, who paid for these journeys?
Well, these guys just paid for their own. But then they wrote about them, and so some of them made money on their books that they wrote about their journeys to the West. So now some of the earliest scientific studies of the West were made by a pioneering German naturalist by the name of Prince Maximilian and Duke Paul Wilhelm of Wittenberg. Paul Wilhelm made no less than 8 surveys of Western flora and fauna between 1823 and 1851.
Can you imagine, though, setting up a camp with these people that aren't used to the Western wilderness? They must have been totally lost.
Well, but remember, they had all these servants. They had these hired employees that were helping them. And I know they hired some Western people to kind of guide them through the West to know where to go for food and water, things like that. So they obviously had some help. But anyway, by the time the Earl of Dunraven's book appeared, virtually every country in Europe was sending travelers to the States because of what these people had written. Some of these visitors made the trip a lot of times just to visit their relatives that had moved here. Germans in Texas, Scandinavians in Nebraska, and some Eastern Europeans in Kansas and California. But the English, these were the main people. And the thing about this, they didn't have a language barrier.
Yeah.
You know, some of the other, you know, the Germans, the Scandinavians, they had a language barrier. So a lot of times they settled in their own communities, you know, so they could speak the language. So, but the British, they could go anywhere because they spoke English, obviously.
Yeah, pip, pip, cheerio.
Yeah. So, but the first really good reports on the West from British writers commenced about as early as 1820, when merchants from the Hudson's Bay Company sent back encouraging descriptions of the Oregon country from their fur trading posts. And then came big game hunters. You know, they heard about this. They wanted to come out, you know, and shoot deer and elk and buffalo. And probably the first was a guy named Sir William Drummond Stewart. And I believe I did a story on him once a long time ago.
I think you did, yeah.
And in the 1830s, he traveled clear as far as the Rocky Mountains.
Wow.
And in 1849, hundreds of British fortune seekers joined the gold rush to California, and they wrote home about how glorious and wonderful it was in the Sierra Nevada country, and whether they struck it rich or not, you know, they wrote about it back home. So, and that probably encouraged a lot of people to say, okay, I'm going to go see what I can find.
Do you have pictures of what their camps look like?
Not really. You know, if I did some research, I could probably find some. But
can you imagine
quite a few tents?
I was going to say, taking it, putting it up and then taking it down and putting it on pack horses?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So even in the 1850s, information remained actually still kind of spotty, and popular English notions of the West were based largely and sometimes unreliably on the romantic novels of people like James Fenimore Cooper.
Yeah.
He was a New York gentleman farmer who had never gone any further west than Detroit.
Oh, my.
But he wrote about the West.
Yeah.
So what would-be British travelers needed most was a comprehensive report written from their own point of view and offering them enough hard detail and advice to permit sensible planning for journeys into the West.
Did any of them ever face Indian attacks or anything?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they all did. My family lived in England.
Now, just a minute. Our family.
Our family.
Our family. Cousin.
Lived in England, moved up to Wales, and then left out of Liverpool and came across.
Well, you came over with the Beatles.
With the Beatles. And so my ancestors were part of that big migration.
Again,
as
you, you keep saying yours. Listen, man, share the family.
Yours was the German side. So, you know, actually no one did any more to satisfy these needs or to interest Englishmen in the West than a guy named Sir Richard Burton.
Oh, Sir Elizabeth's
Richard,
husband.
Sir Richard Burton the First.
Oh, the First.
The First.
Okay.
And he set out on a tour in the wilds in 1860, and he was actually quite a celebrity. At age of 39, he'd fought in the Crimean War in India. He'd explored Africa. He'd explored the Nile River. He'd been all over the world.
Hmm.
So he was kind of one of the first guys to really do a lot for promoting people coming out west. So the starting point for Burton's tour was the railhead of St. Joseph, Missouri, and there Sir Richard laid in supplies, and his included a pocket sextant, two compasses for navigation, a thermometer, and, quote, cigars in extraordinary quantities.
I see.
And, quote, for comfort, he said, there is nothing better than an old English tweed shooting jacket, and he added, Let no false shame cause you to forget your hat box and your umbrella.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, you wouldn't want to go west without an umbrella, Zach.
Well, I'd feel naked without it, yeah.
that's one of the first things you'd
sure.
say. Sure. Yeah. Well, weapons, of course. Burton's arsenal consisted of two rifles, a couple of revolvers. He talked about the uses of these and other weapons. And he actually offered instruction back to his home people on the Western art of gunslinging.
Oh, really?
He became an expert, so to speak.
Kind of a quick draw McGraw.
Yeah, so I'm going to read what he said about the art of gunslinging.
I can't wait.
Okay, and this will probably take the rest of our time. Quote, "The revolver should be carried with its butt to the fore. And drawn, it should not be leveled as in target practice, but directed towards the object. By means of the right forefinger laid flat along the cylinder, whilst the medius draws the trigger. The instinctive consent between eye and hand, combined with a little practice, will soon enable the beginner to shoot correctly from the hip."
Uh-huh.
"All he has to do is to think that he is pointing at the mark and pull."
You said butt first on the pistol.
Yeah.
I read a story, and I need you to verify this, that a lot of people in the Old West that tried to wear the gun with the butt first, they ended up shooting themselves in the leg. Look at it. You got to turn the pistol over.
Yeah, and some of them did. Some of them did. But anyway, Sir Richard's lethal hardware was not intended merely for hunting game. He confessed, quote, "the mundane desire of enjoying a little skirmishing with the savages."
A little skirmishing.
And
tell that to Custer.
You'll like this. He had acquired letters of introduction to the commanders of several military districts, incorrectly assuming that these officers were under constant siege by one or another Indian tribe, and they would be really grateful for the help of a genuine British soldier.
Really? the naive attitude they had.
It was, it makes me wonder if after being here, then they realized, okay, it's not quite what we thought.
Amen.
Yeah.